Good afternoon, everybody. Can I, on behalf of the Global Strategy Forum and the Special Relationship Campaign, welcome everyone to this debate, How Special is the Special Relationship? My name is Paul Bavistock, I'm one of the founders of the Special Relationship Campaign, which is a body that has been constituted by businessmen, lawyers and policymakers who are worried about what we believe is a damaging trend towards imbalance in the relationship between the United States and the United Kingdom, especially in matters of trade and justice. So we're delighted that there is a very eminent panel to discuss the nature of our special relationship today. It's going to be chaired by Mark Spragg, and Mark will introduce individually each of the speakers before they make their contributions. They'll each speak for 7 minutes, and there will be a question and answer session at the end. I hope everybody will proffer their insights, questions, opinions. Mark Spragg, who's our chair, is a partner at Jeffrey Green Russell, and he is their lead partner in the defence of the white collar criminal issues. And through that work, he has become rather associated with knowledge of the extradition treaty between the United States and the United Kingdom, as he represented, among others, the NatWest 3, of whom you may have heard. So he's singularly qualified to lead the debate, and with that, I shall hand over to Mark.
Thank you very much. Well, welcome, everybody. If you look on Wikipedia, which is not always known to be accurate, and you type in special relationship, you can find that there is a special relationship between the US and the UK, but also between Canada and the US, between the UK and Canada, between Israel and the US, between Australia and New Zealand. We're going to concentrate today on the special relationship between the UK and the US. George Bush, of course, said in 2005 that the US had no greater friend than the UK, and he said in 2003 that UK was the US's closest friend in the world, but he also said that America had no greater friend than Mexico and no better friend than Canada. So he seems to spread his good wishes around. Well, I wonder if there's been perhaps a subtle shift in the special relationship, because going back a year in July 07, Lord Malik Brown, just as he was appointed Foreign Office Minister, said that the UK and the US would no longer be joined at the hip in relation to foreign policy, and that the UK really ought to start forging relationships with the European leaders. Min Campbell famously told Gordon Brown to get a grip, and said it wasn't the relationship that was at issue, it was the nature of the relationship. So I'd like to first of all introduce Professor John Dumbrell, who's going to explain a lot about the history of the relationship. Professor Dumbrell is a professor in the School of Government and International Affairs at Durham University. He's the author of a number of books on the special relationship, and he's actually an expert in US-UK relations following the end of the Cold War. He's currently researching a book on the foreign policy of Bill Clinton, and has a particular interest in contemporary American foreign relations.
Thank you, Professor Dumbrell. I'm just going to make a few general remarks to introduce the topic of the special relationship and set it into context. But the first point I want to make really is that the concept of a special relationship really is quite recent and really dates back to World War II. In 1942, Winston Churchill informed King George VI, quote, "Britain and America are now married after many months of walking out." My second point is that it is really fundamentally a British concept. I mean, American diplomats and spokesmen rarely use the term, and indeed always say we have special relationships with Canada, with Mexico, Israel, or France, a very special relationship with France. It tends to be very much spoken about in British accents, with the implication that Britain will gain influence above its own intrinsic importance, if you like, as a way of trying to attach itself to superpower. It tends to be associated also with the concept of Greeks and Romans, which essentially is Harold Macmillan's concept. It's difficult to describe it in ways that are not offensive, but broadly speaking, someone said it's whispering civilizing noises in the ear of a barbarian. It's an experienced power, to put it slightly, instructing his junior. So I would also argue that the special relationship does exist. I mean, there's a lot of symbolism and sentiment associated with it, but it does exist as a real existence. And the real existence, I think, is twofold. The first one is in defence. I mean, I think it's true to say that Britain has closer defence relationships with America than with any other country, and actually vice versa. You can argue about US and Canada and so on, but at least arguably, the defence closeness is unique. Geoffrey McCausland, who wrote a book for the US Army, in fact, about 2 years ago, he wrote, quote, no other nation has a daily involvement in the planning and preparation of operations that the UK has with the US. So defence relations, obviously nuclear, but also in other areas as well. Secondly, intelligence. The intermingling of British and American intelligence, as far as I know, is more close than any other two countries. GCHQ, for example, seems to operate as a kind of default mechanism for the American National Security Agency. And in fact, when the NSA actually ceased to function in 2001, GCHQ actually took over the role for about a week or so of the American National Security Agency. So a few more generalisations about the relationship. Economics, I think, kind of stands aside from the closeness. Since Britain became a member of the European Union, economic disputes have typically involved Britain being on the European side and against the American side. So economics seems to kind of stand outside. It is primarily defence and intelligence. During the 1990s, I think that the relationship was disintegrating, was falling away. The Cold War glue, which had held it together since the late 1940s, had disappeared, and there wasn't really much geopolitical basis for the relationship. This was, and indeed I wrote a book in 2001 saying the relationship was over and it's all finished and so on. Now in fact, of course, it was reinvigorated by Tony Blair's reaction to 9/11. And I just say a few words about that, about 2 minutes left. I think that Blair supported Bush in the war on terror in the way that he did, largely out of personal beliefs. It wasn't so much that the institutions of the relationship forced Britain into supporting America in the way that it did. It's more the fact, I think, that it was Blair's own personal commitment to the war on terror, plus his understanding of the responsibilities of the special relationship, bandwagoning, if you like, with the United States. The reason I think this is really twofold. First of all, Vietnam. Harold Wilson was put under far greater pressure to send troops to Vietnam than Blair was put under pressure to send troops to Iraq, but Wilson was able to resist it. Secondly, Blair was given a way out. If you read Bob Woodward, you read lots of other contemporary accounts, it's quite clear that Bush and Rice and their top people said to the British, you know, we understand you've got problems, and maybe you can come in the Reconstruction period. We don't necessarily expect you to send troops immediately in the invasion. So my hypothesis, my suggestion is that it really wasn't the institutions of the relationship that pushed Britain into supporting America, it was more Blair's own personal beliefs. My last point really is to say, of course, that in the first months of Brown premiership, there was a clear attempt to distance Britain from the United States, at least symbolically, which has now been put into quite a dramatic reverse. My very last point is really to say that the special relationship, I think, is like a layered cake. It's got three layers. The top layer is elite leader relations. Jack and Mac, Kennedy and Macmillan, Reagan and Thatcher, Blair and Clinton, Blair and George W. Bush. The elite interactions at the top. The middle is kind of very intimate, bureaucratic intertwining. Most obviously the military side, but also on the diplomatic side. Very, very complex relationships that really go right from the top, right to the bottom of the two governments and two bureaucracies. And at the bottom level is public opinion, which doesn't matter in the long term, particularly British public opinion. And my very last point is to say that for the special relationship to survive, all three layers need to be vital and have some real existence.
John, thank you very much. Our second speaker is Andrew Tyrie, MP. MP for Chichester since 1997. Prior to that, he was a senior economist at the European Bank for Reconstruction and Development, Prior to that, he worked at the Treasury and was full-time advisor to Chancellors of the Exchequer, Nigel Lawson and John Major. He's founder and chairman of the all-party parliamentary group on extraordinary rendition. Andrew.
Thank you very much. I agreed with virtually everything that's just been said on my left. It's important to remember the historical background to the special relationship. For the Americans, it's always been a matter of interest and power politics. For the British, heavily laden with sentimentality. And you can see that, it goes back 100 years, you can see that going all the way back to the row over the Cleveland letter. The strand of sentimentality in the British attitude to the Americans has often clouded, in my view, our judgment about where our national interest lies. I also think that it's important to bear in mind that for the US, we're not really a special ally. They have, as you pointed out, a good half a dozen who they tell are the most special allies when it suits them. I want to look at, just make three, posit three possible approaches to the way the British can deal with this. I think there are, this is only a way of describing it for the purposes of discussion, but I think there are probably three. One is to carry on hugging them close, from the British point of view. One is to try and adopt some alternative strategy that amounts to rivalry, which might be thought of as something along the lines of French policy from time to time. And the third is a public dialogue of allies. And as you can already guess from the way I've posited all that, I think that that's where we need to take policy. On the hug them close strategy, I think this has been a catastrophe for Britain. I think we have less influence now than we've had at any time on the Americans. And as a result, we've weakened our position in the rest of the world, despite the fact that the economy has made us proportionately more influential than we would otherwise have been. We've found ourselves aligned with a foreign policy that is wholly alien to our instincts. I mean, of course, the policy of regime change and military intervention on a preemptive basis in breach of international law. And it's probably not in our interests either, our security interests, to be associated with, so closely associated with those policies. I think we have less influence in Washington than we've had for a very long time. If we were a bigger country, much bigger country, it might be different. But our ability to influence the US so directly is always going to be limited by our size, our military capacity, and by ability to use soft power. And it's our soft power that is particularly, in my view, weakened by our hugging them close strategy. Let me say a few words about the other two options I've just suggested before my time runs out. I don't think rivalry is an option. Not for Britain at any rate. Partly because of our culture, our history, strength of our connections with the Americans, I don't think there would be domestic political acceptability for it either. I don't think the French, apart from feeling good about it, have got very far with it themselves. I think the main effect, if we did go down that route, would lead the Americans to worry less about Europe. After all, Europe is only, from their point of view, perhaps a slightly degenerate former sphere of influence which they need to concern themselves much less with than they did 20 or 30 years ago now that the Cold War's ended and other rival areas are of the world becoming more important to their foreign policy. But I also think that to the extent that this policy became a hard policy, a policy of rivalry, it would weaken the influence of the West and therefore make us less secure in other ways. We are all, we Westerners, creatures of the Enlightenment. We are trying to export values. The only question is what means we use to do so. And while trying to generate a policy of rival spheres of influence would have a high feel-good factor in France and possibly occasionally in the Foreign Office, the policy would, I think, cut the very security planks on which Europe sits and would make us much weaker. Let me just end with a few words about what I mean by a public dialogue of allies. This was pretty much what Margaret Thatcher provided us with, although people don't believe it. She certainly believed that a superior moral policy, a foreign policy, bloomed almost exclusively in Anglo-Saxon gardens, and she certainly thought that the best policy for the West was nearly always one that was hammered out among the Anglo-Saxons. But this didn't stop her engaging in spectacular rows with the Americans over the Falklands, Grenada, nuclear missile defences, and right at the end, actually, over nuclear disarmament and the Reykjavik summit. So I think we've tried the public dialogue option, and I think it would be understood in Washington, and I think we might get more out of it. Tony Blair never risked it, I think, because Labour's history of anti-Americanism made him vulnerable all the time to the allegation that he was distancing himself from the Americans if he did it. I think that's why one of the reasons why Gordon Brown has swung back so quickly from what appeared to be an initial distancing. But that option, the option of a public dialogue of allies, is open to a Conservative government, I hope, which we have in a couple of years' time. And if we do have it, I think it would form a sound basis for thinking through a much more robust foreign policy. The very last thought on it, I would add, though, is that it's only by increasing our influence in Europe that Britain will ultimately get the leverage it needs in Washington. Some say this means an agonising reappraisal along the lines of Dulles outlined for us all those years ago, but we've certainly already been agonising 30 years, and I think maybe the time has come to be a little bit more clear-headed about this, particularly in view of the opportunities that a much more diverse, enlarged Europe presents to us. In fact, I think it's only by strengthening our ties with Europe that we can hope to maintain a special relationship with the United States in the 21st century.
Thank you very much, Andrew. I probably can't emulate Humphrey Littleton and talk about people seated on my left and my right because Samantha's not here, but in all practical purposes, Bronwyn Maddox is seated on my right. She's the chief foreign commentator of the Times. Prior to that, she was the Washington Bureau chief, and her book In Defense of America has just been published in the US and is due out in the UK in September, so I've done the plug for you. Okay. And I wonder whether during your few moments you might pick up on one of Andrew's points that he believes that the UK has less influence in Washington now than previously.
Thanks very much. I'll certainly pick up on that. I'll talk about anything, as I said to you when I was coming. I agree also with a lot of what Andrew said. I've always slightly recoiled from the word special in the special relationship. It's got, to me, a rather childlike cloying quality. An evasion, it seems to me, is actually saying what is supposed to be special, and especially difficult, you might say, in the past few years. But I think, as both Andrew and John have said, what we're really talking about is whether Britain can claim a special closeness with America in a relationship where America has a lot of competition for that role, and in a relationship that is inevitably going to be asymmetrical, to the point of civility, some people thought, in the Iraq War. And my answer to that would be that yes, it can, but it's a relationship that Britain, I think, has handled very badly in the past few years, and certainly since Iraq. I just want to step back a tiny bit, if you forgive, some anecdotes from today, but to just pick up on the references to sentimentality we've had in the whole American-European relationship. I was talking to our Berlin correspondent this morning about the enormous effort that is going into the staging of Obama when he arrives there on Thursday, next Thursday. And now that Angela Merkel has vetoed the Brandenburg Gate as a backdrop, there's enormous effort going into what could be instead the American embassy, which is near the gate, but not it. But the cameras might still capture the gate. On the other hand, it's just an embassy. The Schöneberg town hall where Kennedy gave his speech, the Tempelhof airstrip where the US flights landed, the Berlin airlift. Enormous effort on this staging, and then even more on the one German sentence that he might say after Kennedy's Ich bin ein Berliner, or even Reagan's in English, tear down this wall. But actually rather less attention on what he might say in English after that about the nature of European-American relations, particularly, say, on trade and on defence. And I would hope that more attention would swing to that as he actually descends. If that's the right verb. There is this sentimentality always that comes with the relationship, but I think it is time to take a rather crisper look at it all, and what in particular Britain might try to do with it. The anti-Americanism we've been talking about, and that Tony Blair was so conscious of having to counter, has been there for a long time, and you could trace it back to the birth of America, but I think to notice it as a real political force, you really have to look at the fall of the Soviet Union, which left America, obviously, as the world's sole superpower. And it liberated Europe, it seems to me, from having to depend on America, and people were then freer to criticize it. And that chimed in very neatly with the rise of the anti-globalization movement, that extraordinary conjoining of trade protesters and people who... and farmers and people are really going to lose out from the trade and environmentalists and so on. And you did have American triumphalism rising up at the same time, sometimes very overtly. I remember at the G7 summit, as it then was in Denver in 97, I think the boasting that America had, in official documents from the US administration, that America had perfected the system of economic management was so blatant that it brought formal complaints from the other countries. Iraq and 9/11 then came, and the responses in the rest of the world, initially sympathetic to 9/11, but mixed pretty soon as the Afghan conflict started, and the divisions after Iraq we all know. I think Britain did handle the Iraq negotiations with America very badly. I would entirely take the description that Tony Blair did it out of personal conviction. We have had it so many times and from him himself. But at the same time, it seems to me that the argument that Christopher Mayer made in his book, Washington Confidential, there was an enormous row about the book, you remember, and Foreign Office and others feeling he shouldn't have published it, but the serious argument of that book was that the British government had not tried to strike much of a bargain with the US in return for its support, that it was done entirely on a profession of shared passion. And I think that's exactly right. Tony Blair said many, many times, this isn't a quid pro quo, I'm not asking anything like that. But it seems to me that you might as well, if you are going into something, the stakes like that. He asked for anything as for more American engagement in the Middle East peace process, which is too detached from the Iraq mission to have been a useful request. And it seems to me the kind of things he could have asked for that would have made a difference to the British experience in Iraq would have been more money for Basra, for the south of Iraq, more American support, say, for the British operations there. In the end, I think Basra got about 1/20th of the development money earmarked, certainly in the first couple of years, for Iraq. And I think that is simply one practical example of how directer conversations and more confident conversations from Britain to America might have put Britain on a firmer footing in that extraordinarily difficult conflict. What should it do now? Well, I think it's worth any leader, Tory or Labour or Liberal, arguing against the anti-Americanism that is still noticeable, even though people are hoping that once Bush is gone, it will be a whole new era. Because, of course, any American president, even Obama, who has taken such pains to sound very different from Bush, any American president is going to want to show Americans that he's following their interests. And I think that is some of the message that Obama is likely to deliver next week once he gets past his sentence of German. The tough love, some of the papers here have called it, and I think that's right, on trade, on military. He's going to remind Europe that it's not going to have it all its own way at all. I think, as I said, it is worth arguing against the anti-Americanism, because we owe a lot to America. First, in shared values, and I think that's been easily forgotten in all the upsurge over the Iraq War, that American values are Western values. But also, in practical terms, in economic growth, in innovation, the military, our military dependence on America is inescapable, as anyone going to Afghanistan knows. They provide by far the bulk of the military power and intelligence there. And I think just a crisper and more direct conversation about how exactly the practicalities of that relationship should work now, on trade, on military, on dealing with Russia. That's the kind of conversation, the kind of tone we need to have from now on, after what has been a very bad few years.
Roman, thank you very much. And our final speaker is Dr. Naomi Matsukata, Senior Policy Advisor for Alston and Bird, previously served as Director of Policy Planning for the U.S. Trade Representative Robert Zelick, where he advised on WTO-related matters. He also teaches at the John Hopkins University. Now,
thanks, Mark. The challenge of going last is always trying to maintain faith to your remarks, because you hear so much and you want to comment back. I think the only comment I'll make is that I'd like to take John's cake and eat it and try to put the relationship in a bit of a different light. I'm going to focus a little more on the economic relationship, which I think is in fact can be called very special in many respects. If we look at the significance of the UK to the United States in economic terms, I think we start seeing a different kind of relationship develop. For example, the UK is the US's sixth largest trading partner, which is not an insignificant place in the pecking order. In the past 10 years, there's been a 57% increase in trade and services between the two countries. There's been a 30% increase in trade in goods since 2004. But most importantly, I think, is that the U.S. is the largest destination for U.K. investment, and vice versa. U.S. investment into the U.K. is the highest here in the U.K. And you can almost equate it to almost $1,000 per American is U.K. investment. And so you can see that there is actually a fairly significant U.K. influence into the United States. May not be military, may not be security, but certainly on the economic front, we're seeing a great deal of influence. And more importantly, as trade becomes more about services and delivery of services and capital, the investment that's going into the United States becomes that much more influential. So I think in that light, the relationship can be called somewhat special, and it really rises above some of the other comments that have been made about the strategic relationship between the two countries. A few words about what's going on in the United States. I think, of course, we're all very much watching what's going to happen between McCain and Obama. But at the same time, the United States is very much at a crossroads. And in many respects, this discussion about the special relationship comes at a very timely time, where we are going to be reexamining where we look to who our friends are, who our trading partners are, and such. But in the area of trade, we have really a serious crossroads, in the sense that for the past two terms, starting with Clinton, the United States has had an enormous run in trade liberalization. We've, of course, finished NAFTA at the beginning of the Clinton administration, established the WTO, and then thereafter have signed 14 free trade agreements with different partners. But really, we've really kind of come to an end in that if we look forward, there aren't that many trading partners left for us to sign agreements with. If you look at Japan as one or the European Union as another, I think it's fairly clear that both of those negotiations would involve significant political difficulties. So we look at that and say, well, maybe we need to pause there. But also, at home, there is a debate that keeps taking place between the protectionists and the free traders. And when you look at that debate, it's really a debate about old trade. It's about trade in goods. It's about trade that stops at the border, tariffs are addressed to it. It's about those that support free trade, they see trade as economic policy. Those that are protectionists see trade as social policy. And that debate really does not advance us at all in the new economy of the services. And if the United States wants to move forward, it has to start looking at trade from a very different perspective. But second, it also has run into a credibility problem. there have been two actions that have been taken by, one by the United States Congress, one by the executive branch, that has really undermined our credibility globally. First, on the congressional front, we had an issue just this past spring when Speaker Pelosi decided to withdraw what we call fast-track authority in the consideration of the Colombia Free Trade Agreement. Now, this comes at considerable expense for us, given the fact that we had negotiated an agreement with Colombia. They had ratified that agreement at home, and they had brought it to the United States, at which point the United States turns around and says, sorry, we don't like the terms of that agreement right now. We need you to make some changes. So take it home again, make those changes, and re-ratify, which they did. They come back to the United States, and at that point, Speaker Pelosi says, I'm sorry, we just can't take a vote on that agreement because we have a presidential election going on. So obviously, the credibility of our negotiations are greatly undermined as a result of that. A second example, not congressional but executive, is most recently, the small country of Antigua brings a WTO case against the United States. It wins. The WTO rules in favor of Antigua, at which point the United States says, sorry, when we negotiated the gas agreement that would have allowed this ruling to be enforced, we didn't really mean what we were saying at that time. So we're going to withdraw our commitments to this congressionally ratified treaty. There again, the implications are, one, credibility on the global stage for the United States about negotiating treaties, but two, undermining the very rule of law that underpins the WTO. Now, this is something that may come to haunt the United States at some point when the U.S. takes a case against the Chinese, for example, and the Chinese lose, and they say, well, gee, we remember the United States when it decided to say, well, we didn't really mean to make that commitment, so they do the same thing. So there is a real credibility problem that's running here in the United States. But more importantly, getting back to the relationship itself, if the United States can solve some of that credibility problem, there is an opportunity for the UK and the US, in a sense, to export its values through a different way, and that is through the shared idea that trade and services, and that the economy is changing, can work to the advantage of leading economies like the UK, the US, Japan, and such. And that is because the primary competitor today we see is China. And in China, if you have an economy that is bringing standards down, whether it be in the rule of law or in regulation, we can't compete. Our economies rely heavily on the protection of intellectual property and other matters and services. And therefore, the cooperation between these economies can go a long ways to becoming and remaining competitive with the developing economies of today. So in many respects, I think that if we talk about the special relationship from an economic perspective, not only is the UK very important to the United States, as played out in the statistics that I gave at the beginning, but also because in the shared comments here of exporting values and the idea of agreeing on regulation, for example, I think the Washington and London probably share more in their view of regulation of business than Washington does with Brussels, for that matter. So I think in many respects there is a lot to be said about the relationship, and that the focus, if looked at from the economic perspective, really does speak to a special relationship.
Thank you very much. Can I just raise a couple of points with the speakers before I throw it open to the floor? I'd like to ask you now on the economics. We all understand that the US is the biggest investor in the UK and vice versa, and that's terribly important. But where do you think we go to on our problems with the arms deal with Saudi Arabia? Supposing we acknowledge what the Americans tell us to do, which is to reopen the investigation, mm-hmm. and if we don't, then they say they will. Do you see a problem in us losing enormous investment from the Middle East?
Yes, I think it's a very important question, because I think there is an issue, certainly in the last 6 years, of the United States really expanding its borders in an extraterritorial way. And I think that's exactly what you're trying to address. And I think that is something that has to be discussed between the two countries in a very frank manner, that recognizes that the economic interests of U.S. economic partners are being hurt by the policies that they have taken more recently. So in that regard, there's no question that the expansion of our rule of law or law enforcement outside of our borders has impacted the ability for our third countries to have a more robust economic relationship with certain partners of theirs.
But do you think there's a risk to the UK that if we continue with our special relationship, and we do things that the Americans ask us to do, that we will lose the incoming investment from other parts of the world.
But your question assumes that the special relationship means that UK has to subordinate itself to the United States. And I think, quite frankly, I would say quite the opposite. I think that the UK should not see itself as subordinate to the United States. In fact, that it should negotiate as an equal and preserve its interests, as you suggest there.
Okay, thanks. And Andrew, I have one point for you, if I may. Last week we read in the paper that the contract that had been awarded to Airbus to build the wings for the air-to-air refueling planes for the American Air Force, that was going to be, the government had said, okay, there's some problem with the tendering process, we're now throwing it back open to tendering, and it's widely expected that Boeing will win the contract previously awarded to Airbus, to the detriment of an enormous number of jobs in the UK. Is that something that Parliament should be getting involved in?
Well, I think I'll find out the facts before answering that question.
Okay, but it's possibly something that we all should be thinking about in terms of the pressure that the Americans can put us into. The special relationship, John, it's not only war and technology, but that is a very important part of the relationship, isn't it?
I see it at the heart, really, the defence and intelligence. On the economic side, I appreciate that there is a sense of shared values, that the British, London and Washington tend to share a strong commitment to free trade. Indeed, the figures about the investment is quite striking. We're the biggest investor in America and vice versa. However, what comes across, really, certainly if you think about the Iraq war, is how little, what I think about is the steel tariffs, the imposition of steel tariffs, right at the height of the negotiations over Iraq. And I appreciate that this is largely because of the decentralized nature of American economic foreign policy making, but you really do get the impression that economics kind of stand aside from the central military relationship.
Of course. Public opinion, my final point to Bronwyn, where do you think public opinion stands now as to the importance of the relationship? Because certainly there were some surveys done in 2006 which showed there was a dramatic reduction in the public view.
Worst ever. I think historically they're the lowest there.
Hmm. It's come back a bit in the past few months. So if you're asking me to tell you what recent polls I've read, I was just trying to see
if you had a feeling for what the public's
That's
view.
Interesting. You mean here?
Yeah.
And in the States. I think things have improved, but in a way, everyone have their own take on this. Things have improved, but we're waiting in a kind of limbo to see what the next U.S. president is going to is going to say. I'd call it a limbo, better than the rest of the
world. I think the vast majority of the British people have still powerful sentimental attachment to the United States, and I don't think that's changed dramatically, and is not going to change. The Americans can exploit that, actually, and have done historically from time to time, but it's also a huge opportunity now for the Americans. I speak as an Atlanticist and someone who finds the odious occasional moral superiority, tone of moral superiority that you hear coming out of one or two continental European capitals from time to time, something that we should all deprecate. But I do think that there is enormous scope right now for a thirst, not only in Britain, particularly in Britain, but also elsewhere in Europe, for turning a page on the whole Bush experience. And saying this was 8 disastrous years with rather curious rhetoric and some rather nasty translation or inappropriate translation of that rhetoric into policy. Now America can say and can send a message which will change, I think, those poll ratings very sharply. A new president early on can say we recognise that some mistakes have been made. We want to govern we want to lead the West multilaterally, and that means we want to restore many of the ways of formulating policy, which perhaps partly they were an illusion, but which the illusions of which many Europeans sustained many Europeans in the way they approached their relations with the United States. And I think that if that's done, there will be a reversal of these trends, and we will see a sharp pickup in support from America. I think Obama, particularly Barack Obama, has a massive opportunity to catch the mood in Europe. His general language of change and his apparent freshness is exactly what I think a large chunk of middle opinion.
That's right, and that's why there's going to be big crowds to greet him. On the other hand, that's before he said anything very precise about what he wants from his relations with Europe.
In terms of polling and anti-Americanism, Britain is normally somewhere down in the middle, really, of European opinion. France is always the most anti-American, and Ireland and Italy tend to be the most pro-American. But in terms of polls also, perceptions of the United States tend to vary enormously with the president. I mean, anti-Americanism was very strong in the 1980s. Reagan was very unpopular. George W. Bush is very unpopular. Mm-hmm. The last point is the Guardian poll on Monday said that the British public favours Obama over McCain by 5-1, which is quite extraordinary.